I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
So, I was giving a presentation at work the other day to a bunch of new hires. And one of the things that I asked them during the presentation is I show a bit of code, which is deliberately awful C++ code, just to sort of prove a point. And it's just a bit of string formatting. But I asked them, how long do you think this function will take to run? Mm-hmm. Just ballpark it, you know, order of magnitude. In fact, two orders of magnitude. Where do you think it'll be? And it's amazing that a room full of people, and there were some folks who are much more experienced in the room too, the range was absolutely astronomical, from people saying hundreds of microseconds to people saying 10, 15, 20 milliseconds. You know, there was kind of, you know, we were sort of playing Price is Right rules, you know, who was nearest without going over. And, you know, the one person got it about right. This particular bit of code was tens, low tens of microseconds, right? Even though it was absolutely awful. And it struck me that we all don't really know how fast, we don't really internalize very well how fast computers are what they're good at and what they're not good at. Even if you spend most of our waking lives thinking about it, it still hits us with surprise.
Right. I have to think about it like I have to like do the math on it. I have no intuition. Right. Like
looking
at a piece of code, like it's just, I have to like sit down and be like, okay, that's going to be this and this is going to be that. And I got to probably look some things up on the internet. It's not intuitive at all to me.
Absolutely. So, you know, trying to get a handle of how fast a computer is is tough. I mean, I'm just thinking about it right now. Like, one of the things that amuses me very much is when I plug my laptop into a docking station, like at work, and there are these two giant monitors plugged in with, you know, 32-bit color per pixel, however many, you know, 4K displays, and I plugged the tiny, thin little USB-C thing into my laptop, and somehow, miraculously, that amount of data is flowing out of my computer continuously to drive these screens. And again, like, it boggles my mind how much it is. But if I sat down and did the math, it's probably fairly reasonable, right? Well, it has to be, because it works, right? And we're looking at each other right now, and there's not a problem.
Yeah.
But developing intuition about these things is tricky, especially when computers have surprising edge cases.
Yes. And it's really easy to be off by many orders of magnitude.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, how fast is a modern PC? Like let's say on the computer I'm on now, it's like, let's just say 3 gigahertz, which means every tick of the clock is a third of a nanosecond. And just putting that,
stupid fast.
My golly, a third of a nanosecond. Now, I mean, you brought this up when we were talking about this before, but there's a nice way of thinking about what a nanosecond is.
Yeah. So Grace Hopper, who is obviously a famous woman in computing, has this great talk that she did many years ago, talking about explaining, I think, to generals why certain satellite communication wasn't going to be possible in the way that they were thinking about it. And she had a piece of wire that was, you know, she sort of called a nanosecond long, right? And that was like the amount of distance that light could travel in a nanosecond. And it was a little under a foot, I think like 11.8 inches, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
She sort of held it up and be like, this is a nanosecond, right? So your satellite is way up in space, many, 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 many nanoseconds away, right? And that, she was obviously talking about like communication, but it's like so useful to when I am trying to intuit, when I'm trying to sort of break out of the, like, I don't have an intuitive sense for how this works. I think back to that all the time of like, you know, about a foot is a nanosecond.
Right.
And that is how fast light is moving. So if
that's
you're
like
doing something,
the cosmic speed limit, nothing can go faster than that. So
exactly.
That gives you like the baseline, at least, like this is, if everything was perfect, that's as fast as you could go.
Exactly. And I will many times sort of envision that wire that's a foot long and sort of like twist it around into a small shape and project it onto the chip of like a CPU and be like, there's a wire that's in there that is, a, like, as you say, a third of the length of a foot, right? So only a few inches. And that's how long it takes for the light, essentially,
right,
to move around in there. Now, it's not actually exactly like that, but it's just sort of like my intuition sort of clicks in a little better when I think about it.
When you think, and I mean, that obviously doesn't take into account the fact that electrons in wires go slower than light in a vacuum.
Yes.
They're not just moving in a sensible way, although there's arguments about how the propagation of charge and voltage really works, but there's a transistor that takes some time to flip state and all that kind of stuff. So that's all the kind of like the physical reasons why. But as you say, it gives you at least something you can stare at and look at, and you look at like your arm from your elbow to your wrist and go, "There's a nanosecond there," roughly speaking.
Right.
So, but first of all, a nanosecond, right? I don't know. You know, as engineers, we are probably more used to talking about time or things that are nano scale, nano something or other. But to put it into perspective, right, like a millisecond, which is like the sort of standard human, wow, that's fast, is a thousandth of a second. And, right, you know, you'll be hard pushed to do anything on a human scale that isn't in the tens of milliseconds. So the way that I think about this is like when I used to work in video games, we always wanted to try and get things in under a frame, like the refresh of the TV screen that we were projecting to, which in the UK is 50 times a second. Over here, it's 60 times a second. So you need to completely recalculated the next viewpoint, taking into account all of the AI, the user's movement on the controls, anything else that's going on, you're playing music and all that kind of stuff. And you have to be repainting the screen completely from scratch every 60th of a second, which is roughly 16 and a bit milliseconds. So that is sort of human scale time, right? And so when people were guessing would this string formatting routine take 20 or 30 milliseconds, even though it was egregiously bad, there's no way, well, never say no way. But it wasn't as bad as an entire game repainting the screen.
Right.
That's not a reasonable comparison. But again, computers are surprising. So I'm not trying to call people out for this. This is just what it is.
Yeah.
So that's the millisecond. So then if you go 1,000 times smaller than a millisecond, you get microseconds, which is kind of a more typical performance level that you might measure things at. So like when you're running non-trivial slices of code, you might be measuring things in terms of microseconds, because that's, again, it's a sort of sensible domain for most things. But we're way out below what humans can perceive at that point. And then 1,000 times smaller than a microsecond is a nanosecond. And now we're into the domain that the computer itself is actually ticking along at. And so we're all, that's just to kind of get our head around how many thousand times smaller than things that we know is a nanosecond. And, you know, the idea that we have something which is reliably running at 3 gigahertz and therefore a third of a nanosecond for every clock tick. And not only is it doing one thing at a time, it's doing each CPU on your die is doing probably a half dozen things in parallel, plus the chip itself has got many CPUs on it, and you just kind of get the idea of how much mind-boggling performance there is on a tiny piece of sand in a plastic wrapper, which is just what it is, right?
It's cr- yeah.
So it, when we were talking about this earlier, it reminded me that I had totally and utterly stolen an amazing article, very short article by Jeff Dean, I believe, from Google, one of the original engineering folks at Google, where he had put out like a list of these are just the things that take computers time, and here's how many nanoseconds or milliseconds they take. And I've got a spin on that where I try and equate it to human time, so that you can develop a bit of an intuition about, like, well, what does this mean? So that when you go, oh, yeah, I didn't, the information wasn't in the cache. I had to go and get it from main memory. How long does that kind of quote really mean? Because I don't think any of us have a decent intuition about what, you know, oh, it's 230 nanoseconds. You're like, that's still so small, I can't get my head around it.
Right.
And so I was just going to go through some of these with you, and we can sort of talk about them as we go. But so the first thing. Computers can add numbers and exclusive OR numbers and do other sort of elementary arithmetic, not multiplication, division, but like add, subtracts, XORs, ands, compares, in usually in one cycle. Now, there's a bit of pipelining going on here. I'm going to draw a line over that. But that means that like it takes one CPU cycle to add two numbers together, which is a third of a nanosecond. And that's already bonkers. But let's use that as our baseline.
Right.
And then rather charitably, I'm going to say that a human adding, say, a few digit number together takes 1 second. Like, who's good at it, right? If you're good at, like, mental arithmetic, and I say, what's 392 plus 4,964, perhaps you can do that in your head in under a second, right? So that we're going to use that as our scale for the rest of this conversation. And so
a third of a nanosecond equals, of computer time, equals 1 second of human time.
Of human time, exactly right.
Yep.
So then let's sort of move up the hierarchy of the kind of elementary operations that a computer is doing under the hood all the time. So the next obvious thing is multiplying, right? Mm-hmm. It takes, and again, this is hand-waving completely, of course, because it's different for every revision of computer. It's different for different architectures and stuff. But let's, on the next 86, such as I'm on right now, it's anywhere between 4 and 6 cycles to do a multiply of two numbers together. These are integers, for what it's worth, anyone who's really counting. And so that works out as 1.2 nanoseconds, thereabouts, 0.3 times 4, right? And in human time, that's 4 seconds. And again, now we're still in roughly the ballpark of that makes sense to me. I, you know, probably faster than I could multiply numbers together, but it's not a bad approximation. I'm sure there are folks who can do, you know, 3 or 4 digit multiplications in their head like that. So 4 seconds. So what about division? So what would be your instinct, your guesstimate of how long it would take a human, and we'll work backwards, to do a long division of two numbers?
Long division of two longs might take a while, but you know, like if in assuming that you don't have the lookup table, you haven't got it basically like memorized where it's like 100 divided by 10. Then I many seconds. Like you're gonna maybe bust out some pencil and paper and write it down like that. Yeah,
and it turns out that intuition is about right. So computers can't divide integers that much better than humans can. Actually, with a big fat caveat that the latest round of Intel machines have somehow made it go a lot faster. But at least when I first wrote these slides, and for most CPUs that I'm used to dealing with on a day-to-day basis, integer division is anywhere between 30 and 100 cycles, which is a lot longer. So that's 10 to 33 nanoseconds, which in human time of this scale is 30 seconds to a minute and a half. So sounds about right. You know, you're sketching on a bit of paper, and that's how long it's going to take you to divide things into. And again, the reason it's such a wide range actually on the computer side is that it does depend on the numbers you gave it. Unlike multiplication and addition and stuff like that, where it just does 32 bits worth, it's worth noting that just like long division, once you kind of get to the end, you're like, well, there's nothing else to divide. Let's stop now. We might as well finish. We've got the answer now. There's no need to go through the other bit. So it varies. And again, that's something I like to point out to people who are new to computers is unlike most of the other things in the chip, because the division takes up a load of space, there is usually only one divider per CPU, and it's not pipelined. So some of the other things, although I'm saying it takes 4 or 5 cycles, there can still be multiple multiplications going on at once. You can have, you know, 3 or 4 multiplications going on at once. Each of the different stage of the multiplication, it's just that there are 4 or 5 stages that the multiply goes through before it comes out the other end. So it takes 4 cycles to get the answer. But with a divide, if you're doing a division, it's taking you 30 to a minute and a half. You can't be doing anything else at the same time, at least in that divide. You can't get another divide started. There's no way of breaking the work up. So the reason I bring that up is because everyone's favorite data structure is a hash map. And almost every hash map, at least naive implementations, use a modulus with how big the hash table is to find which slot. You know, you do your hash, you get like some giant number, and you go, mod 257. There's 257 entries in my hash table. Which slot am I going to look in? I will just mod. And that's a division. And it's long. It takes a while. You can only do one at a time. So so there are actually some trade-offs. You'll see some hash tables will actually not use a modulus, or they deliberately use a power of two sized hash map table, bucket size. Even though it doesn't give the best distribution of hashes, it's probably worth spending more cycles with a better hash function and then using an AND to get you into your table than it is to rely on a divide, because it takes a minute, in human time.
Right.
So then one of the other things that CPUs do that we've talked about on this podcast before, or at least I love to talk about, so I know that we've talked about it more than once, is that they try and get ahead of themselves. They look along the stream of instructions, and they try and do more than one thing at once. So they're trying to unlock parallelism by finding sets of instructions that can run together in parallel, even though they weren't necessarily written explicitly to be parallel. So this is not like threads. This is just a single stream of instructions. It's like, well, there's an add and then there's a multiply, and the add and the multiply are distinct. Let's do them together. But in order to do that, it needs to go beyond branches. So there will be some conditional branches in the flow of instructions. And that would normally stop you if you were trying to get ahead of yourself, because you're like, well, I don't know which way it's going to go until I get to it. So I guess I can't do any more work. But thankfully, hardware engineers have gone, well, why don't we just make a guess? And then if we guess wrong, we'll undo the work that we did speculatively, and, you know, we'll chalk it up to experience. But if we get it right, then, hey, we're unlocking more parallelism. Mm-hmm. So branch mispredictions is the name for when that is guessed wrong, guessed incorrectly.
Okay. Yep.
So that means that the pipeline has to flush, it has to refill up, and it has to do a bunch of extra work. Now, the average branch misprediction, depending on when it was noticed, can be anywhere between, here I've got it in nanoseconds for reasons I can't remember, but anywhere between 5 and 30 nanoseconds, which is between 15 seconds and a minute and a half. So it's almost as bad as one of those divides that we were talking about, which is really interesting.
So you can multiply quickly too.
What's that, sorry?
I said you can multiply quickly too.
Yes, right. Right. So, I mean, it's amazing. There's no sort of human analog to this, I guess. This is just the, I'm trying to think what it could be. You know, if you're running down the list of instructions in a recipe, and one of the instructions was, if the previous instruction is blah, then go to step five. And you're like, well, that hasn't finished yet, right? The egg is still boiling or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to do the next few things. And then, you know, you eventually go back to step two and the egg is now finished. You look at it and you're like, oh, actually the egg has set. It's a terrible analogy. I haven't thought this through at all. And you're like, oh, crap. Now I have to go and redo all that stuff. And I have to throw away the stuff that I was doing. And that you lose a minute and a half clearing up the desk and kind of going back to it. Like, okay, step three.
I mean, how much human effort is wasted by trying to half-ass two things at the same time?
Well, there's that too.
Probably a lot.
Exactly. So yeah, maybe it's a false comparison. Although actually, well, I
think it's a good comparison. Yeah.
I was trying to cook two. So we found a local place that sells pre-ground and pre-made little packs of spices for Indian food, which is my favorite thing to cook. And I love cooking it myself, but I'll always support somebody who's got a new little business. So we went and saw and spoke to her, whatever. And so we bought every single one that she had. And then I was like, well, what are we going to do about this? Well, I'm going to cook two recipes in parallel, which definitely had exactly, as you said, the sort of symptom of I was half-assing two things rather than whole-assing one thing.
Yeah, right.
It came out just fine, actually, and it was delicious. But that's more like multi-threading for what it's worth, although there is only one CPU in this instance.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So what else do computers do that take time?
Reading from cache?
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, well, reading from memory at all, right? You access variables all the time, right? A variable is either on the stack or it's on the heap or it's wherever, but it's in memory. Mm-hmm. And so we know that memory is slow, we're told. Well, that's why we have these caches that are supposed to make it go faster. Mm-hmm. The average access to, an access to level one cache is about the fastest thing you can get. So this is the tiny, tiny cache that's nearest the CPU. It's usually about 32K, which is absolutely ridiculously small. Like, although, you know, my first computer only had 32K of memory, so it's still quite big in that regard. But it takes three cycles to read from L1, which is like 3 seconds in human terms, right? Mm-hmm. We've sort of said. So that's a bit like the piece of notepaper that you're currently working on. Maybe this is a little bit slower than that. Yeah, Ben's holding up a sheet of paper in front of him, right? If you just had to find an arbitrary bit in your flip notebook in front of you, 2 or 3 seconds sounds about right. I mean, again, slightly. So that's L1, and it's tiny. It's as small as a tiny notebook. Mm-hmm. If L2, which is a bigger, further away cache. Now, if we were thinking like L1 is the size of a notebook, this is like a ring binder or a set of ring binders that you've got on your shelving behind you. Mm-hmm. And so typical L2s are hundreds of K, you know, 512K, maybe a meg-ish. Actually, I should check that. In fact, I'm going to check that by running the command on my Kuta now because I've actually forgotten, which is super embarrassing, and I'd hate to get it wrong. So my L2 cache is, 18 meg, it reckons, but I don't think that's right. All right. Well, anyway, it's megabytes of information local to this individual CPU. I bet you that was the sum of them all. So, yeah, I should probably. Anyway, so hundreds of K to low megabytes. That's 10 cycles away, which is 10 seconds away. That seems a bit quick if it's ring binders on your shelf for me, but, you know, maybe the analogy still stands. Level 3 is the final layer of the cache. That's the furthest away, and it's shared with all of the other CPUs. So this is a bit like, I guess, a bunch of folks sitting at desks and having like a centralized library of commonly used books in between them all. Right. That's going to take you around about 40 cycles to get information. It varies there because it depends on whether it's in the part of the library that's actually physically close to you or not. That actually matters now. And so that's 40 cycles, so 40 seconds. Again, now that seems a bit fast for a library in my analogy. But really what we're getting to now is like, what happens if the cache system fails and you actually have to go out to the real memory, you know, the things you literally slot into the motherboard when you're building your computer and you have to actually get the data off of that.
Right.
We're talking like 100 nanoseconds then, which is 6 minutes. So that's a trip. That's a trip down on the elevator to the, you know, the archives to then find that one book you want to get out and then get back on the elevator, back up to your right, and then put it in the shared library. Again, it's 120 nanoseconds, which sounds tiny, and it is tiny because we can't comprehend time scales that small. But in the working life of a computer that's adding numbers together as its like primary job, that's like twiddling your thumbs for a tea break. Right, I can make a cup of tea, a decent cup of tea in 6.5 minutes. And that's what you're taking every time you miss your cache, which is why that kind of thing becomes really important when you are talking about really performant code. Just to sort of finish this off then before we go into more general stuff, but like if you're talking about reading from peripherals, like the real genuine outside world, as opposed to things that are literally soldered on your motherboard or very close to, reading something from an SSD, at least when I wrote these slides, which was a while ago, was, you know, 50 microseconds, which is like 2 days.
That's jumping orders of magnitude there.
Yeah, we're off now to ordering from Amazon and waiting for it to come through. Right, this is that book we didn't have, and Amazon, you know, it's got Prime delivery and it'll be through tomorrow. So that's, you know, when you need to read something from disk. Obviously, you try to make sure you have lots of things to read from disk so you don't wait for any one particular piece. But if you're using an old school spinning disk and it's not in the right place and it has to seek to wherever your disk, your information is stored on the disk drive, we're talking milliseconds now. So there's another three orders of magnitude different from the microseconds. So 1 to 10 milliseconds on a good day, which is 1 to 12 months on this scale. So this is sending away to somewhere, you know, some obscure company that has to custom make the thing, and then it comes through and it says, you know, 60 days, business days for it to come through, kind of feel to it, right? That is what the kind of level we're talking about when you're reading from a regular old school hard disk.
Right. I was going to say, it's like, this is like, oh, I need this book, but the problem is it hasn't been written yet.
Right. Yeah, that's more of that. I guess so. I mean, yeah, because even nowadays they can print stuff on demand, right? Like, I've got a couple of books on my shelf here that are on-demand printed, which surprised me. I, like, flicked through and I looked at the end and went, wait a second, it says it was printed, what, 3 days ago? It's crazy how far things have come. So my analogy with books maybe is not exactly right. But so then if we're going to go from disk drives, which are physically inside the chassis or chassis of your computer, and we start talking about networking more generally, like the internet, if you ping your switch neighbor, that is the computer that is plugged adjacent to you in the switch that you're both plugged into, we're talking hundreds of microseconds, which is about a week. So it takes a week to get to the closest thing that's not your actual computer. Now, maybe obviously networking has gotten better since I wrote these things. And if you're using cool techniques, I'm sure you can go faster than that. But like just as an order of magnitude thing, a week of time to go and get that thing from the network.
Yeah, like, yeah.
So all of these things
but
sort of
so
point
much faster than the spinning disk, right?
Isn't that funny? Yeah, it's actually faster. As long as the computer you're talking to has the response in its own, in its RAM, then maybe you can get the answer back quicker, which is, you know, used by things like Memcached and Redis as exactly for that reason. Mm-hmm. If you when I ping google.com from my computer, it takes me just over a millisecond, which is a month and a half. So Googling it is not the answer. Pinging the other side of the Atlantic back to my home country, if I ping bbc.co.uk, it takes 90 milliseconds. So it's 9 years is that. That's like going to Mars, right? If you want to get the information from the other side of the world. And then obviously the far end of this scale is like, well, it takes me 5 minutes to reboot my computer. So when someone says, can you not just turn it off and on again? If I have to turn it on and off again, especially as this particular machine takes so darn long to go through its post, I've conservatively put that at 5 minutes, which is probably a bit high, but 5 minutes to turn your computer off and then it booting back up again, and then you remembering to come back and log in and all the kind of things that you have to do because you've wandered away to make the cup of tea. In human time, 32 millennia. So that is a civilization ending event in the CPU time. So just think of the computer, man, every time.
Destroying civilizations every time you turn it off and turn it back on again.
Right. I mean, in a way you are. So my first book where I learned to program from, which I'm glad to say the Usborne Book Company still exist, and they have recently like sent out PDFs or made PDFs of those original books, you know, from the mid-80s available. They have little cartoony robot characters that are clambering around inside the CPU, and there's like pigeonholes everywhere, and they're climbing in and putting numbers in pigeonholes to sort of represent writing numbers from memory. So a reboot in that world really is killing them all and starting again. So I mean, maybe it isn't such a wrong thing. I feel bad for them now.
Don't kill all the robots inside the computer that make it work. So I was going to say, like, I want to think a little more about that, those sort of timescales when you were talking about like network access and disk access. So going across the pond over to the UK, you were saying is 90 milliseconds, which is, did you say 9 years if we're scaling this up into human time? Is that right?
Let me get the slide back up. Is 90 milliseconds is, 9 years apparently. Again, someone will probably check my maths and find that I'm completely wrong here, but like, I'm sure it's order of magnitude correct.
Right. And then like, just pinging Google, which is probably hitting some edge server that's, you know, geographically
it's almost
located.
Certainly in the same place that like my provider is plugged into. Right. There's going to be a pop there or,
Right. And how long was that again?
That was a month. 1.2 milliseconds. A month and a half. Yeah, 6 weeks.
Okay. And 1.2 milliseconds.
And I mean, actually, let's think about it. So the UK is 4,000 miles away. Ping is the round trip time, so it's 8,000 miles. I'm going to type into Google right now, 8,000 miles in feet. You can hear my appalling clicky keyboard. And it is, 4.2 times 10 to the 7 feet. So that's
4.2 million.
I'm going to do that. So that's the number of seconds. So we're going to divide it by, that's that many minutes, that's then that many hours, okay, and then that many days, 335, oh, whoops, that's not right, 488, so I don't know where I got I know the number was right from an actual measured point of view, but according to my appalling math here, just the light going across takes 1.3 I've completely balls this up, haven't I? Yes, I've got a several orders of magnitude that I need to work out first of all. And I'm gonna 1.33 No, I've lost myself. This is daft. All right, I made a mistake in terms of that. So it's 4.2 times 10 to the 7 feet. Therefore, it's that many nanoseconds away. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. And then let me do that. Right, there we are. Gosh. So that's 1E9. So that's, okay. That was a much easier thing. I don't know where I was doing the years and whatever. According to this, it would take 42 milliseconds with this stupid approximation of 1 foot is 1 nanosecond. Mm-hmm. 42 milliseconds to get there and back. So
our
time. So that's the absolute maximum time, right? Minimum time, absolute minimum time it could possibly take. Gosh, we got there in the end. I'd like to pretend that I will edit this to make me sound intelligent, but I won't. So the world will be exposed to me being a fool and being unable to do elementary maths on at the start.
But, I mean, so, fairness, there was some division in there, I think. So, you know,
it was. It did take me a minute and a half to get the right answer. Yeah, quite.
But this is, so that's interesting, because I think one of the sort of more surprising things for me in the last few years has been, and we have run into this at work actually, the sort of emergence as the network as an incredibly fast device for data access, on par with sort of local storage mechanisms, especially when you sort of design your network to facilitate that kind of thing. Because certainly, you know, when I was sort of generally thinking about these sort of order of magnitude times many years ago, naturally you'd be like, oh, we want to avoid network access because it's going to be much slower. So, you know, we're going to cache this locally on disk. And even back then it was like probably a spinning disk, but that was still faster, right? And I feel like the tables have flipped a little bit. If you sort of, you know, take that into account with your network storage and the design of the network storage, where that network storage can be on par, if not in some cases, maybe even faster than what you would be able to purchase for the same price stored locally. And then when you couple that with the fact that network storage has the benefit of being able to be accessed by many computers at the same time, then things get also very interesting. So this is like, obviously, like the sort of very micro optimization benchmark area is one place where your preconceptions and your intuition can be wrong.
Absolutely.
But I think it can also be true at these sort of like more macro levels, where you're thinking about the design of whole systems and how they interact, where your intuition about like what's fast and what's slow is maybe off by many orders of magnitude.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, it is definitely true that, yeah, like accessing your neighbor's RAM or your neighbor's is faster than or at least the same speed as reading your own SSD, sort of in the same ballpark. And that could make a big difference, as you say, rather than filling all your servers with terabytes and terabytes of local storage, then, you know, being smart about using shared storage, where maybe I mean, one thing that we glossed over in this, of course, is like that was reading from disk where it wasn't in the file system cache. So that's obviously a system level, operating system level cache. Everything's a cache, right? There's just caches everywhere to make everything go faster. And so very often, if you've just written a file to disk and then you're just reading from it again, then you're not actually touching the spinning disk. So you get it from memory. And so there's that. But obviously that blows up over after at some point if you will run out of memory or the cache gets flushed to disk and new other things come in. Whereas in a shared storage environment, the cache could be on the shared node as well in RAM. And I think, you know, we certain devices that we've got access to have layers in themselves of, well, this stuff is all in fast RAM, this stuff is all in SSD, and it's all backed finally with actual big old fat spinning disks that can write the sort of journal of record for forever storage. And so the layers go through that. But it means that most of the time in a shared environment, it's probably faster to just keep asking for it off the network, have it streamed to you, than it is to try and store it on your local disk and then get it back later. So that, as you say, that affects the way you think about your systems design, which I'd not thought of. That's great.
Yeah, especially when you start getting into the concerns around having to manage that local storage much more carefully. And it's like, oh yeah, well, this is going to be faster if we get it off a disk, but we only have like 2 terabytes of disk. And then when that fills up, we got to swap it out, then we got to refetch it, and then all these other sort of trade-offs that you make. It's like, well, if you're just going to, you know, degenerate into reading stuff from the network all the time because you don't have enough local storage to actually make it worthwhile, like, just cut the local storage out of the equation and read it from the network all the time, right? Like,
yeah, it's interesting. And then maybe concentrate any caching in inside your application and cache stuff in from the network in memory if you need that as well.
Well, yeah, so, but This is a super interesting exercise, though. I love this sort of metaphor of, like, you know, going to get something from your desk or going to the shared library or, you know,
I've got
waiting.
Yeah, in my head, I've got like this sort of
reboot.
Mental plan to like come up with like a really good set of analogies that work this way. And when I dream about retirement or whatever, I've got like, well, maybe we can get someone to do like an animation of this. And, you know, I've got like elves and goblins is like the real way I'd like to express this. I want to make it interesting to like the little robots. Like, that's the reason I brought that up. Yeah. Those books were so important to me as to how I internalized like how computers, quote, really work, I think that there's a new world where we can show this is now how computers really work. And both you can start at the top and say, well, this is just what computers do, adding and subtracting, whatever, haha. And you can have your little goblin with his parchment paper writing out the answers to whatever, and you're like, oh, there you are. And then now we've got two goblins because we've got two CPUs or whatever, and how do they agree on this and whatever. Right. And then you can start going further and further in, and you're like, well, you know, the goblin's instructions come from the forest, and depending on where you are in the forest, it might take you longer to go and get the forest and grow the thing. And, you know, again, it's not really fully thought, formed, but, you know, out of order execution can be done this way, and cash misses and all that stuff, I'm sure, in an interesting and entertaining way, rather than like the boring library analogy we used earlier. But bringing it back onto subject, one of the things that we were discussing recently was at work was how surprised some people were about like other operations. For example, we were looking at whether or not raising something to the power of 2 was the same as multiplying it with itself. And obviously we have a lot, you know, we work in finance. We have a lot of folks who are very mathematically focused. And of course, those two things are absolutely equivalent, right? Raising something to the power of 2 is the same as multiplying it with itself, which is to say it's squaring the value. And these values sometimes are matrices or giant arrays of numbers and things like that. So it's not as straightforward as literally a number. But if we were to just think about it in terms of a single number, like the computer, like I described before, the computer can do a multiply in a single cycle. Four cycles, wasn't it? Four cycles. But raising to the power is not a primitive operation that it knows how to do. It has to be built out of code to do that operation, just like, you know, taking the inverse tangent of something is like a procedure, there's a program that runs. And so there's a vast difference in the number of instructions that need to be executed to raise something to a power than there is to just multiply it with like the circuit that does multiplication. And but they are, we can see they're equivalent, right? You can look at them and say, well, this is a power, but you've asked the computer to do two different things. Now, in some very optimized compiled languages, there might be scope for the compiler to go, whoa, these things are equivalent. But typically, something that is so high level in terms of what the compiler sees that like it's a call to a function to raise something to a power. And unless it has special knowledge that this is really what a power is, it doesn't know that it could be replaced with multiplying by itself. Right. And so that was surprising to some folks, but I guess not to me. I'm like looking at it going like, gosh, that's a very different operation that you're asking it to do. That they're functionally equivalent.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things with the intersection of computers and mathematics where the computer and the pure math don't really agree at all. I mean, you know, obviously floating point operations are an example of that.
Well, there's that too. Yeah.
And we can go into that. But I feel like there's a lot of these kinds of areas where it's like, if you're looking at things from a purely mathematical standpoint, it's different when you map it into computation, right? And it's like sometimes a limit of like the way that computers are actually implemented now and the technology that we have. But I think there's also some, I could be wrong about this, but I feel like there's some things that are just like, no. This has nothing to do with the way that we tricked little bits of sand into thinking. This is just like a fundamental limitation of computation, right? Like you just can't do this in the same way that you can do it mathematically because the physical world just doesn't work that way. I'm trying to think of a good example of that, though. And
I was going to ask you, but I was thinking myself now what there else there could be.
I don't know. Maybe I'm making stuff up. But yeah, I feel like I want to think about that.
Now but, we go quiet thinking about stuff. And like, this is not good podcast material where we're both staring at each other like with our fingers on our chins going,
Yeah, this is like we're nerd sniping each other with this.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, those things can be very surprising. They can be very surprising.
Right, and I think in our case as well, my teeth, in fact, my sort of speaking career is based on the website that bears my name, and the kind of cool things that compilers can do, and that's what really gets me excited. And so my intuition is based around what compilers are able to do. What compilers often can do is to do exactly the kind of transformations that you might reasonably think, like seeing. Not specifically power, but things like that. Hey, look, you're doing this sequence of operations. There is a faster way of expressing them that has the exact same semantics and meaning to the CPU. So I'm going to do some work to change it for you. And so you don't have to worry about these things as a program, which is great, right? I mean, that's ideally you want to be able to express your intent at the highest level where you can achieve your goals. That seems to be a reasonable thing to want. But in interpreted language, like Python, like this particular thing was in Python, there isn't an opportunity to have that sort of high level view and kind of go, oh, I noticed that you're always doing these two things together, or I can prove that this is a constant on this side, and therefore I can do something different from what you said. That transformation is not really part of it. Now, that's not to say that there isn't some clever code somewhere deep, deep, deep down in NumPy that's kind of doing a comparison and go, oh, this is raising to the power of 2. Let's just multiply it. But if it is doing it, it doesn't seem to be helping in the particular case I was looking at. Similarly, square roots, again, is raising to the power of 1/2. And at what point, if you say, well, there's 12 or 13 different possibilities maybe for this. Maybe if you're raising to the power of, 8, that's the same as multiplying by itself and then squaring the square and then squaring the square or whatever. There are algorithms, there are known algorithms for doing raising to high powers for things like encryption, actually, because a lot of the stuff that you do is raising to high powers and then taking the modulus with a big prime and all that kind of nonsense. And so to raise to a high power, you actually devolve the number that you're raising it to into the binary representation then, and you keep squaring and adding and squaring and multiplying, squaring and multiplying with either the thing you just squared or with the original value again to kind of get you up in log 2 steps, which is all cool. But if you were to generally apply that all the time, it takes probably more time to work out the best way to do that than it would do to just have done it the long way. So it's only when you have a compiler that can say, well, look, I'm going to do this the once now, right? You poor program writer, you get to suffer this time while I compile, but then everyone at runtime benefits from the fact that I saw that this was actually this particular kind of multiplication. And in fact, I can replace your multiplication with shifts and adds or whatever, there is all that kind of stuff. So maybe there is a bit of a bias in my recent experience because of it being an interpreted language, which obviously has its own trade-offs. And one of them is that you can write it really quickly. And another one is that maybe you can make a lot of cups of tea while it's doing its work.
Right. Saving on the writing time at the expense of the running time and the coffee and tea making time.
Often that's the right trade-off, right? Yeah. Certainly... If you want to write a little command line tool, then you want to be writing something which is quick and easy and not necessarily hard to write. And so there's always trade-offs.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been a really fun adventure from like the, third of a Grasshopper wire.
Yes.
All the way up to rebooting your computer, taking 32 millennia and all the various effects of those, that vast difference in time. So I feel like I have a much better understanding of how time works and how computers work just from going through this.
Absolutely. And I'm going to leave on the a tweet that I saw from a friend recently, or not a tweet, he was a conference talk that he did, and then halfway through it, he said, the first rule of profiling is that you are wrong. And I think that that's the intuition that everyone should take away from this.
Yes.
Is that you're always wrong.
Start with that, and you, you'll probably wind up in a better place.
Yeah. Exactly. Cool. All right, my friend. Well,
all right.
Until next time.
Until next time.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Twitter at 2CP, that's at TWOSCP. Theme music by Inverse Phase, inversephase.com.